This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Catherine Weber about her new book, The Memory of All That. It's a memoir about her family and certain fairly well-known people in her family. The subtitle, I guess, or the reading line is George Gershwin, K. Swift, and My Family's Legacy of Infidelities. How are you?
I'm great and happy to be back with you, David. And I have to tell you, that subtitle, there were so many subtitle meetings to discuss the subtitle, and it really is George Gershwin, K. Swift, and My Family's Legacy of Infidelities, which was about as long as we could go, but we had to forfeit a lot of other things that would have been appropriate to put into the subtitle.
Well, actually, I think subtitles are really important, because especially today, when, and if you have a title that is, you know, like as yours, The Memory of All That, well, we don't know what that is, so.
Although, it is a quote from a Gershwin song, so there's a hint, and all that, you know, there's a lot of all that in this book, but I agree, a book like this, you do want to have a sense of, you know, what is it about.
Right. And well, let's talk about what it's about, because it is your family, and it's, sometimes families are complicated, but yours in particular seems to have a layer of complexity that is probably not the norm. But you start talking about your father, and it's sort of interesting because in the promo materials for the book, they start talking about your grandmother, Kay Swift. And so, you know, maybe we should start where the book starts. I think I want to ask about your father. His name was Sidney Kaufman, and he was he was a pretty amazing character, I think.
He was amazing in the sense that he was utterly brilliant, but also utterly crazy. But you know, he counts as the all that of the book in the sense that I think it would be fair to say that it's a book where my grandmother's big romance with George Gershwin that took place mostly during the years she was married to my grandfather, James Paul Warburg, had an effect that's like a pebble dropped in a lake with the circles and, you know, the widening circles that continue and continue for decades and decades. And I make the case in the book, which is not certainly where the book begins, but it's the connecting link, that my mother married my father because of the ways that he was like an echo of George Gershwin for her. George was very important to her when she was a child growing up. She was very close to him. And there are many ways that my father resembled Gershwin, and many ways that he didn't. But I do think my mother wouldn't have married my father if it weren't for George Gershwin looming over her childhood. So that's the connection to the parts of the book that are in the subtitle.
Well, and it, yeah, no, I think that's actually an important connection too. That you know, it's always hard to kind of imagine backwards to what people's motivations were, what their psychological makeups were. You know, I often wonder if how people were thinking about things in the past. You know, it's hard for us in the present to comprehend the decision making that went on in that time because those times are so different.
And of course, most of human history takes place before Freud and the influence of Freud on our thinking about ourselves. But why does anybody marry anybody? You know, over time, there, you know, because he had so much land, or because our parents arranged it, or, you know, there are many reasons people marry. And we live in a culture and in a time where people have much more freedom than other times and other places, and yet we are still haunted by the past, and we do all kinds of unconscious things, and we recreate and reenact certain patterns in families. You know, there's don't we all know the person who could have two or three wives, but they all look the same? You know, there's a type. You know, people gravitate to a type. So I think the question of why my mother married my father, you know, is answered by the Gershwin relationship. But I did begin the book as a small child being carried by my father in his arms into the sea, wanting to begin it in my own childhood, even though the stories that my book encompasses begin way farther back before my lifetime. It seemed like a reasonable place to begin in my experience, in my consciousness as a small child. And also maybe that first chapter is a little bit of an invitation to the reader, you know, wade into this ocean with me.
Right, and sort of understand your motivation personally for writing about it. It's not just that it's, you know, these are famous people that were, or near famous or kind of notorious people, but a lot of it obviously is your personal feelings about those people.
And the legacy of infidelities, yes, that are not just marital infidelities, but there are all sorts of ways that people can be unfaithful to one another, you know. And one organizing feature of the first part of the book is my father's FBI records. The FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, you know, were certainly convinced that my father was not a faithful citizen of the United States of America. So that's one kind of infidelity that certainly colors the story.
Although I think that the infidelity, I thought the infidelity you were thinking of was more his inability to be a present father who would...
Oh, that too. My father was unfaithful to my mother in literal terms and had many women, some of whom I knew as a child and described in the book, my relationship to them. He was unfaithful to me as a father. He was unfaithful to his family. He was unfaithful to himself, I think one could say. But I am aware that, you know, another form of faith is patriotism and citizenship, and the FBI certainly squandered a lot of resources amassing hundreds and hundreds of pages on the mysterious, quixotic, inexplicable behavior of Sidney Kaufman.
Although, as you point out, and I guess maybe this is what I thought of, and maybe it's my predilection, that they, first of all, only followed him because they confused him with a different Sidney Kaufman who had gone to fight in Spain as part of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. And so they followed him for all these years, essentially, at least at the beginning, on a bad piece of information.
Well, they actually, the earliest page I have, which doesn't mean there aren't other pages that were not released to me, because I know there are hundreds of pages that were not released to me, but the earliest report, it all begins in 1936 when he's on the radio reviewing a movie and an informant tells the FBI that it was encoded communist propaganda. Although, hilariously enough, later in the pages from the FBI, that same informant is now deemed unreliable. But at that point, they had spent decades following him around. And indeed, there are numerous documents in the file that are about the other Sidney Kaufman, also from Brooklyn, 4 years younger, who was a longshoreman and who fought in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. But they're documenting my father in the same time period. So they are documenting the activities in the 1930s of these two different people while somehow believing they are one person. So I'm convinced that in the other Sidney Kaufman's FBI records, there are probably pieces that belong in my father's records. I think they never, even when they acknowledged the problem, they continued to make the same mistakes.
Well, it is sort of in some ways, frightening because it is the way that a lot of writers have written about the danger of a kind of information society where mistakes are ignored. No one really
cares.
Well,
how different is this than if someone Googled you and discovered that there was, you know, some criminal with your name, you know, and it comes up, and so you don't get a job because they think you're that person. I mean, I think we are all at much greater risk, not only for invasion of privacy, but for these conflations and confusions that, you know, are very, very hard to sort out.
Well,
you know, there's just all this information, and some of it isn't true.
Right, and when the more information there is, the less likely it is that bad information will be corrected. I think that's something that, you know, but aside from all of that, right, that's really a sidetrack because I thought still that it was fascinating to read about your father and his, you know, the kind of connections that he did have to people who were on the left. Not necessarily, I mean, it wasn't like he was involved in some sort of spy ring, but...
Oh, no, but he simply knew intellectual Hollywood, intellectual theater circles in New York, film circles, you know, so... he crossed paths in the 30s with all of these emigres from Europe, many of whom, 30s and 40s and 50s, who were very far to the left, many of whom were actually actively communist. But before that, there was this big crowd of people who were anti-fascist in the 30s. And for J. Edgar Hoover, I think if you were anti-fascist in the 30s, then it's time to hunt you down and see what you're up to in the 50s. And then my father was in the OSS, and the OSS and Donovan's crowd were regarded with such suspicion by Hoover that to have been in the OSS, if they hadn't opened a file on my father in 1936, they probably would have opened a file on him, you know, for that alone in the 1950s.
Well, although it, you know, you really have no way of knowing, and that's sort of one of the issues about your father, is that there's so little you can know about him directly because he was so enigmatic.
Yes, he was enigmatic. Ultimately, maybe he was even an enigma for himself. He was indeed a mystery. And when I applied for the FBI records, probably like many people applying for their family members' FBI records, I had a fantasy that the FBI would explain my father to me, that, you know, all would be revealed. But what I learned was that the FBI just really didn't understand him either, and in fact got so much wrong that it's quite funny. It's actually comic to read the FBI following him around, taking him literally. You know, they tap his phone, they eavesdrop on a conversation, they hear him make a claim that doesn't match their information, and they don't know what to do about it, as if there's something autistic in the way the FBI could process the information.
Right. It's sort of, that is fascinating also, is that, you know, that he as a person, kind of, as you point out about him, he's one of those people who are often involved, I think, in Hollywood, who has big ideas and big plans and will talk about them as if they were real, convincing himself, everyone around him, including those listening into his conversations.
That's right. So if you're tapping his phones and he's claiming, you know, to have all these things going on, but your other information tells you that they're not going on, you know, if you weren't the FBI, maybe you would have the cynicism and the human experience to think, oh, so he's full of hot air.
Right.
So he's a fraud. But instead, the FBI was always looking for something more. They were always looking for his lies or his exaggerations or his inexplicable behavior. You know, why did he import 1,700 East German typewriters that did not have QWERTY keyboards and were completely useless and broke when you touched them? Why did he have 1,700 East German typewriters? Now, to the FBI, you just see them, you know, so concerned, so anxious about it, as if they were all going to be distributed for, you know, to Ethel Rosenberg immediately or something, you know. And in fact, someone owed him money, couldn't pay him for something to do with the distribution of some Yugoslavian film, and he took 1,700 East German typewriters instead. It was just a terrible barter, and my father often had terrible barters. And he never really did much of anything with them, and they rusted into a solid sort of coral reef of failure, you know, in our garage in my childhood. They not having QWERTY keyboards really makes a typewriter not so useful in the United States. But the FBI had no, you know, what can I say? The FBI has no sense of humor. The FBI thought he was up to something, and it never dawned on them that all of his schemes and all of his contradictions and all of his behavior was that of a crazy person. He was grandiose. He wasn't running a cell, you know. But the FBI had a failure of imagination. It is utterly fascinating reading.
Well, and I thought the story of him was pretty interesting as you presented it. But then, of course, we segue into your grandmother, Kay Swift, who was also an amazing person with an amazing life. You know, I thought that when you were, you know, when you talk about people in the past, it seems to me that people, that some, there's something about the 1920s that is very modern and very similar, more similar in some ways to our own time, Just because of the way I think the world was working in the 20s, it was a really fruitful period of social change. And
You know, I think you're right. I think that's a really interesting point, and it certainly is a time period that those of us who were not alive then look back on, you know, with such fondness and longing in a certain way.
yeah, well, it had that kind of openness and a sense of, the modernism. Now, you can look back and with the birth of modernism and where it comes from, and the art changing in the early 1900s, and music was changing, and you have all of that. You can see where the roots of it were, and then how World War I disrupted society and took it out of its old pathways. I read a book about World War II that talked about that. That World War II literally changed the world socially because it disrupted the social relationships and put people in touch with each other who had never been so. I think World War I probably had a similar kind of earth-shaking social effect beyond its horror, the horror of the war and the.
And the lost generation. But I agree with you, and I think that the equivalent, the Weimar Republic, you know, the life in Germany, you know, before the rise of the Third Reich, you know, had some of those same incredible freedoms and freedoms of expression. I mean, you know, the Bauhaus. When you think of what was being the music, the art, you know, what life consisted of. You know, cafe society in Berlin and in New York were remarkably similar, actually, in the 1920s. And I do think it's an incredible time. And I think, you know, that many members of my family were people who were making things happen in that time period. And then there were the complications because my grandmother was married to James Warburg, my grandfather, who was a young, promising banker from the Warburg family. His father, my great-grandfather Paul Warburg, you know, was the architect of the Federal Reserve System. And speaking of wrong information that's out there today, if you were to do a search on Paul Warburg, you find many more references to him that are on websites and blogs and in publications that are rabidly anti-Semitic, that quote the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, that accuse him of having financed Hitler, although he died in 1932, and having, you know, single-handedly started World War I, World War II, the Bolshevik Revolution. He is accused of being essentially the ringleader of the international Jewish banking conspiracy. And it's an extraordinary set of charges to hold against someone who actually had amazing integrity and was in some senses genuinely noble as a citizen wanting to, you know, make the world a better place. So he's a fascinating character. But my grandfather, as an advisor to Roosevelt in the first months of the first administration, was part of the sort of first so-called brain trust, is a fascinating character who I think is little understood. He constantly sabotaged himself professionally by expressing himself in a certain kind of Warburgian entitledness, where he thought he could advise presidents and then would be quite annoyed with them if they didn't do what he said. And yet he was confounded. He could not triumph over George Gershwin in the tug of war for his wife.
Well, but he was also, interestingly, aside from being a banker, he also wrote music himself and sang.
He was the lyricist for my grandmother's, you know, best music. She was classically trained, but with George Gershwin in her life, and theirs was originally a musical bond, a very deep musical connection is what brought them together. She began writing popular show tunes, and my grandfather became her lyricist. And their first big hit was that wonderful song, "Can't We Be Friends?" They then wrote the entire score for the musical "Fine and Dandy," which includes the title song that is ubiquitous today. And you know, for not only was "Fine and Dandy" the first Broadway show, the first hit Broadway show with music by a woman in 1930 when it opened, but it's also still the only Broadway musical with lyrics by a banker.
But
And for a banker, he was a really good lyricist.
right,
You know, can't we
exactly.
be friends? Can this be love? Fine and dandy. Those are the three big standards. But they wrote quite a number of other songs that are really all quite extraordinary. And I should say that one of the other things I do in life is work tirelessly as a trustee of the K. Swift Memorial Trust to preserve my grandmother's legacy as a composer. And the K. Swift songbook has just been published at long last, which is about 50 years overdue, but it means that people who are interested in her music now can find the K. Swift songbook.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting. I mean, her life stands out in the book, I think. She was a pretty extraordinary woman, in many ways, and for a long, long time as well.
Well, there's a part of the book that, in a way, is, her biography, because I'm writing about my relationship to her and my relationship to all of these other relationships, but I do really explore parts of her life that have never been documented or written about before, including her second marriage to a cowboy, where she went to live on his ranch in Oregon, wrote a book about it, which was made into the movie starring Fred McMurray as the cowboy and Irene Dunne as my grandmother. The movie was called Never a Dull Moment, although critics disagreed with the title. It is entertaining. It is a wonderful piece of film history. It also was the two little girls in the movie were played by Gigi Perreau and Natalie Wood in one of her first roles, and it's one of Irene Dunne's last roles. So it's a curiosity of a movie, but it's got some charming moments.
And she was with him for quite a while.
8 years. By the time the book came out, by the time the movie came out, they were divorced. But the cowboy, Fay Hubbard, was really a charming, if rough around the edges, man who she was genuinely devoted to. And one of the adjustments, one of the things I learned when I was writing the book, was that it wasn't just a sort of madcap exit strategy from New York, because George Gershwin died unexpectedly in 1937, at which time she was director of light music for the 1939 World's Fair. She had left a job as staff composer at Radio City Music Hall to work on the World's Fair. She met the cowboy at a radio, at a rodeo, excuse me, at the World's Fair, and eloped with him after just a couple of weeks of a courtship. The headline in a gossip column was "Rodeo Romeo Romances K. Swift," and she ran off. So she ran off with a cowboy, and for many people, this just seemed like, K. Swift, what will she do next? But it was a way to leave New York. The devastation of George Gershwin's death, was still with her. But she really loved him. She was genuinely devoted to him. And I learned that she was twice pregnant with his child and lost both of those babies. She was in her 40s and she miscarried both. But in her letters to her best friend, Mary Lasker, she made it very clear how devoted she was to him. So it wasn't just a fling. It wasn't just some sort of fun little adventure. She meant it. She was really committed while she was there. So that was something very revelatory for me about my grandmother's life.
So how do you think she was? I mean, obviously she was really deeply affected by the relationship she had with Gershwin and the, kind of, I don't know how you would characterize the end. It was really his dying. But although they had separated in some way that didn't maybe, wasn't really clear to me whether that was something that was going to last. I mean,
It was a hiatus because he had gone to the West Coast, and it was a timeout. It was hard to say what would come next, but they weren't done. And as he grew ill, he made it very clear to a number of people that he wanted to go back east and he wanted to go back to her. It's hard to say what would have happened if he had lived and lived, but they could have ended up apart, but they weren't done. And it was a life interrupted. He was 38 when he died on July 11th,
Oh, very sad. And
1937.
sad also to read what you had to say about how he died, that the diagnosis was missed, that he probably, as I think, at least what I took away, is that he probably, even with the medical technology of that time, he might have been able to be saved, from the from dying. Now, it's not clear that that would have,
Yes, and then, yes, and there is a psychoanalyst on the West Coast who has just written a paper that's about to be published that I quote from in my book, Mark Leffert, MD, has really delved meticulously both into the background of Gregory Zilborg, who is the villain of my story, who is a manipulative, fraudulent psychoanalyst, who presided over George Gershwin's misery over a number of years of symptoms, which he simply attributed to hysteria and melancholy and neurosis, that Dr. Leffert believes are signs of a very slow-growing astrocytoma and a seizure disorder, with symptoms that go back possibly 14 years before Gershwin died. So the received wisdom that it was a tumor that was missed, but he couldn't have been saved anyway, is really probably wrong. And what killed him was a fulminating cyst that actually displaced brain matter, and he died of that brain swelling. And then they operated, and it was way too late. But it's a tragic story because it really was a needless death, and Gershwin would have, you know, possibly lived a full lifespan, and who knows what music he was going to write next.
No, I know. It is, well, you can never feel anything other than sorrow and loss when someone really special dies young. But it is awful to, you know, to think about this guy, Zilborg. And he definitely comes across as the villain, not only for his treatment of Gershwin, or lack of treatment of Gershwin, but also for being a psychoanalyst who slept with his patients.
Yes, he extorted all kinds of money from them and gossiped among them. And yes, I mean, one of the people that he, you know, sexually abused was my grandmother, who went to him because her sister-in-law, Bettina Warburg, recommended him. Bettina, my great-aunt Bettina, was a psychoanalyst, and Zilborg had been her training analyst. So my grandmother goes to him because she's in this terrible conflict. She's in this terrible bind. She loves two men at the same time. Because one of the parts of the story that I think my book really adjusts, as opposed to what has been on the record so far in Gershwin biographies, is that my grandmother didn't fall out of love with Jimmy Warburg. Their marriage wasn't in trouble. They did not have an open marriage. She fell in love with George Gershwin very unexpectedly, very uncharacteristically, and now she was involved with two men at the same time, and this went on for years, and I think it was an unbearable conflict for her. It was simply something she never, you know, would have been prepared to deal with and didn't like, but couldn't find a way out. So she went into analysis with Zilborg, and the next thing she knows, she's being compelled to have sexual relations with him on his analytic couch. So now her life is that much more complicated. And I do think that he turned both Jimmy and George against her when they became his patients. And she finally left him, and he was angry at her terminating the so-called analysis, and made good on his threat to her that he would turn her soon-to-be ex-husband and her lover against her and hurt her. And I think that what Zilborg did affected the rest of her life. I think it affected a lot of people.
Despicable.
Yes.
And you really wonder, you know, this sort of Svengali potential of psychoanalysis, that's just, you know, the power can be misused.
Well, when one of the important pieces of this story is that he had misrepresented his credentials when he came to the United States, so that he actually didn't have the training he claimed he had, and therefore was not the doctor who would have had a better ability to recognize neurological symptoms, if he had actual, authentic, full medical training. He did complete his MD in New York. It's true. He did go to medical school in New York, but it was on the basis of the credentials he claimed he already had in Europe that are simply not possibly true. And that, to me, is a huge discovery that Dr. Leffert has made. So his authority was self-conferred. I am a great believer in psychoanalysis, despite the damage psychoanalysis, or so-called psychoanalysis, did to so many members of my family at the hands of Dr. Gregory Zilborg.
So after, you know, after this kind of fraught period of the 30s and 40s, your grandmother continued to have a pretty colorful life, and you knew her when she was, when you were an adult.
I knew her all my life, because, and she lived into her 96th year, so My children knew her. My children knew their great-grandmother. I was very close to her. I'm named for her. I am Catherine Swift. I was geographically very close to her. So I feel that she was really probably the most important adult in my life, throughout the first part of my life, far more emotionally reliable and loving than my parents. So, she was very, very important to me.
Right. Well, that comes across in the book. She's got, she's clearly in your psyche and in your pantheon of people really important to you.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the book. I guess I should point out, and just for the record, make it known that we have this connection through one of your father's lovers, Beatrice, who was married to my father's first cousin, Sidney Buckman.
Yes, and when my father met Beatrice, she was Mrs. Sidney Buckman, and Sidney Buckman, of course, was certainly someone the FBI was also keeping track of, and a tremendously talented figure in film, unlike my father. But he became involved with Beatrice when she was married to Sidney Buckman, and he remained involved with Beatrice throughout his marriage to my mother. And I don't know that there was a moment when their relationship ended, but she was someone I knew as a child, and she shared an office with my father at one point, and I would go off and have lunches with her when I was a teenager, and she encouraged me as a writer.
Yeah, I kind of had wished when I read that I, some of the people in my family were still alive, that I would have been able to ask about it just out of curiosity, what
yes.
people on this side knew. And, I don't think I ever met Beatrice in my life. So for me, it was like filling in a little piece of my family, even though it was, part of the family by marriage. But I did know that their daughter, and who recently died, in fact. But anyway, it was just, it's really interesting to read about your one's own family from someone else's perspective, particularly in this context.
Yes.
A little complicated. But
and of course, I believe your father knew my grandmother, Kay Swift.
Oh yeah,
well.
I think very. He knew her well and really admired her. So.
And there are many overlapping circles. And of course, one of the things I grew up knowing and discovered more as I researched the book, because my book is really a hybrid of an I remember this kind of memoir and true researched biography. I did a biographer's kind of researching, but then a novelist's kind of memoir writing, at the same time or in different parts of the book. But my father and my grandmother had crossed paths with so many of the same people and knew so many of the same people, although I do not think they knew each other before my mother met my father, although one of the stories I tell in the book is that one of my Warburg relatives tried to tell me that everyone in the family knows that my father, Sidney Kaufman, had been someone who had an affair with Kay Swift, and that was how my mother actually met him, that my father was, in effect, one of her mother's cast-off loves. I do not think that is a true story, but it is the kind of story people in my family not only think they know, but feel free to tell one another. So there are the eerie overlaps, for instance, that my father coincidentally, who knew George Gershwin just socially in passing in Hollywood, visited him in the hospital not long before Gershwin's death, when Gershwin was there for medical testing at the end of June in 1937.
Oh, I know. I thought that was totally weird.
It's just totally wild. Yeah.
Yeah. There are some strange kind of coincidences, or we'll call them synchronicities here.
But my father has that Zelig quality, but he's always the person at the edge of the photo. He's not necessarily central to anything, but he manages to meet everybody and be present for everything.
Well, which he was working pretty hard to do, I think. Actually, we should mention before, it's probably, we can't go on too much longer, but I love the fact that your father actually is responsible for Aromarama.
Yes, one of the world's worst concepts in movies.
Right.
And it was traumatic to me as a child, going to that movie, because, it's hard to breathe through your mouth for all those hours. dollars. I mean, it was just a huge disaster. It almost bankrupted Walter Reed because his theaters had this Aroma-Rama movie with these horrendous chemical smells that were sort of piped into the theater through the ducting system, but then didn't. They had no method for dispersing the smells, so the smells kind of built up, and it was just a disaster. And they had to reupholster theaters. They had to reupholster everything: the seats, the curtains, the carpets. And many of the Walter Reed theaters were originally actual theaters, you know, burlesque houses, theaters, you know, so they had all that fancy upholstery. They were not what we think of as a modern movie theater in the least. So imagine it saturated with these horrendous odors from this disaster that was Aroma-Rama.
Right. And by the way, for people who are listening who are not old enough to know, Aroma-Rama was, the idea of it was that you would watch the movie and smell the smells that were going on in the movie at the same time as you were watching it, a kind of third sensory input to visual and oral that just was a disaster, almost like a kind of mass hallucination in the movie business of people believing that anyone would want that.
And such a gimmick, because it's bad enough. I mean, you know it's a bad movie when the music is telling you what to feel. And here you have smells trying to tell you what to feel. But meanwhile, my father not only had this bad thing, he stole it from Mike Todd. Mike Todd was making a movie with a process he called Smell-O-Vision. And I have to say, I do think Aroma-Rama is the better name. But Smell-O-Vision was a much more subtle process. And because my father beat him into the theaters by just a few weeks, he pretty much ruined it for Smell-O-Vision.
Well, it might have, but Smell-O-Vision might have failed on its own accord.
It might have. And Variety dubbed it the Battle of the Smellies because they were in theaters at the same time. And, of course, John Waters more recently has revisited this concept in a kind of ironic, campy way with a movie with a smell track, I think. An idea whose time probably should never,
right,
ever come.
A good idea that we can talk about and enjoy, but hopefully never experience again.
That's correct.
It's been really great talking to you, Catherine. I enjoyed this book immensely. It read beautifully. You're obviously a good writer, and it's a terrific book.
Well, I really appreciate that. You know, it's a diversion for me because I'm essentially a novelist, and I think I'm meant to be here writing novels, but it really, the time had come, and it was a book I really felt I needed to write, and I wrote it the way a novelist tells a story, which is a little indirect some of the time, but it's a story that so far has entertained and moved a lot of people, so I'm happy.
Well, I'm glad you did it. So thank you again. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Catherine Weber about The Memory of All That, George Gershwin, K. Swift, and My Family's Legacy of Infidelities. Thanks again, Catherine. I almost
people do that.
Yeah, well,
people do that.
It's going to probably happen more and more.
That's true. Thank you so
Thanks,
much,
Catherine.
David.
Take care.